Hello and welcome back to the Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast. We're into September. It is time for overlapping races. I love this time of year because I get to watch bike racing morning, noon, and night. I know lots of people, particularly those who host things like the Placeholders podcast, complain about this time of year. But hey, we get to talk about the Vuelta today. We get to talk about the CMAC Ladies Tour today. And we get to talk about the Grand Prix Quebec and Montreal. Lots to talk about here on the Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast. I can't wait to do it with my co-host, bike racing analyst extraordinaire, Cosmo Catalano.
Hello.
How are you, Cosmo?
I'm excited to have races in my own time zone. So I can,
yeah, not even that far away from you. Just a couple.
I thought about going up. It didn't. No, it's not even. I mean, it's a Montreal. People would spontaneously go to Montreal when I was in college, which granted is 2 hours closer to Montreal than I am right now. But
Wait, where did you go to college?
I went to Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. It is a small college, sir. But there are those who love her. Daniel Webster.
Yeah, I feel like I call you bike racing analyst extraordinaire. I could also call you, you know, Ivy League scholar, Cosmo Catalano.
I consider myself an Ivy League frat basement expert more than I think a traditional scholar. If you need a detailed guide to where and how to get excessively intoxicated in disgusting surroundings, I can do that if you're in Hanover, New Hampshire. Just like, oh, my beta is 20 years out of date. But I could do an Animal House tour. It would be pretty cool. Fun.
Awesome.
Some of the references still hold up. So, yeah.
Also joining us, you've already heard her, Abby Mickey, host of the Wheel Talk podcast, Colorado alumna and former bike racing pro. Abby, welcome back to the show.
Well, I was just wondering because I may have graduated from the University of Colorado Boulder, but I went to University of Vermont in the beginning of
Woo!
My collegiate career. Yeah.
Go Cats.
So I was like, oh, 2 hours from Montreal. I was
nice.
There too. There, a lot of times we drove up.
That's in New Hampshire, right?
To where
University
the drinking
of Vermont.
Oh, stop. One bike race in Maryland, and suddenly Dane thinks the Mid-Atlantic is the most important place in the universe.
All right, let's talk bike racing. Let's.
It wasn't even a world tour race.
I know.
Yeah, it was the largest race in the United States, though. How about that?
That's pretty sad.
Yeah, it is. Before we get into the show, let me tell you that you should head on over to escapecollective.com/join and sign up. And I'm telling you this because we are funded by our supporters like you. Well, hopefully like you. You can become a reader for just $6.99 USD a month. You can sign up for a full membership for $11.99 a month. You can save 30% with an annual membership, by the way. So there's all kinds of different ways for you to support what we're up to here at Escape Collective. And that includes, yeah, podcasts like this one, Wheel Talk, Placeholders, Geek Warning, everything we're doing over at escapecollective.com, debates between myself and Johnny Long about whether Sepp Kuss can win the Vuelta, etc. And you'd also be just joining a pretty cool community because our supporters are really cool. And on that note, let me toss out some shout-outs to some of our lifetime members. Our lifers deserve a lot of credit for being just so crucial to what we're doing here. And we got to say thanks to Omar Castillo, Kel McCulloch, James Hallisey, Kevin Johnston, and Olivia Evans. Thanks to all of you for being lifers. We really appreciate it. All right, on with the show. We've got the Vuelta. We've got the CMAC Ladies Tour, which was the final race of a very illustrious career. We're going to get to that. And then we just finished. We're Abby and I were sitting here in the call as we watched the finale of the GP Montreal. So lots of World Tour racing to chat about today. Starting with the Vuelta, we are heading into the second rest day as of recording time. And as of recording time, none other than Mr. Sepp Kuss.
American.
Durango, Colorado native, is wearing red, which is pretty spectacular for American bike racing fans. It's been a little while since we had a race leader at a Grand Tour.
Hold on. Did Kaylee say that Durango was his hometown just because the leader
probably.
Of the Vuelta is from his current place of residence?
I mean, maybe. That, he did say that on the Placeholders mm-hmm. podcast. I could confirm. Yep. I listened to the Placeholders podcast. I don't know that there's any Vermont-based cyclists who lead Grand Tours in this day and age. So I understand what he's going for here, you know, and he does live in Durango. He's lived there for a little while now.
There is Unbound winner Ian Boswell, proud Vermonter.
I was going to say.
And he is a Vermonter's Vermonter. He is, well, when we get no tourist.
Well, we get to gravel racing, you know, fine. Sure. But yeah, Sepp Kuss leads the Vuelta a España. And he does it now, I would say, a little bit more commandingly in a way, because the main rival to his team, Jumbo-Visma, since we last had our conversation, Cosmo, things didn't go his way.
You got it. We got it. This non-chronological stuff is going to confuse all of our...
I want to set the scene for where we are in this conversation.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, so...
Previously, Cosmo... I'm pretty serious bike racing podcast. I'm doing the little recap at the beginning of the soap.
In 30 seconds, what has happened since we last podcasted?
We finally got our sort of GC race situation a little settled with the TT on stage 10. The Ghana won. Remco was close. Sepp held up really well. And a couple of maybe interlopery-looking GC people became less GC-looking. But then on stage 13, our next mountain stage, Remco just did not have it. First time going uphill after a descent to start the stage, and he was pretty much out of it, like minutes, many, many, many minutes off the back, 20 minutes off the back at the end of the day. And Sepp Kuss and his teammates went 1-2-3, and now they are 1-2-3 on GC. And that's pretty good. We saw Remco come back the next mountain day. He took the stage, but still like 16 minutes down. And then today's stage 15, he was in the break again, was 2 seconds back at the line, but that really was due more to the tactics of Rui Costa and the group that contested the stage. And I kind of like to see it too, because I remember back in the day when Ivan Basso collapsing spectacularly at the Giro and then coming back and winning 3 stages. I remember Vinokourov having a really bad day and then suddenly having several impressively, possibly impossible good days. And so to see Remco come back, get the win, but also show the effort of that the next day is reassuring, let's say, as a cycling fan.
Yeah, I think so. He's clearly going for the mountains classification now. And after 15 stages, he is by far in the lead in that classification. Yeah, which he's definitely not giving up. He's not just, you know, packing it in. Good for him for still fighting. And obviously that was a very emotional stage 14 win for him the day after he had such a horrible, horrible stage 13. So that's where we are. We have Sepp Kuss in the race lead after 15 stages heading into this final week here. His teammate Primož Roglič and his teammate Jonas Vingegaard filling out the current provisional podium. Juan Ayuso, to me, well, he's in fourth, so the numbers suggest that he's the closest competitor. I also think he is the closest competitor. He's the one who maybe has the best chance of jumping into that podium battle. But yeah, let's break it down. Let's get into this race and where we are so far. Let's kind of talk about some of the moments that have made the race since we last chatted on this podcast. And I want to get away from the GC battle a little bit first. There's all kinds of GC things to talk about. I want to talk about Rui Oliveira real quick, because the lead out that he put in on stage 12 to deliver Juan Sebastian Molano to victory in Saragossa was incredible, perfect, beautiful. He had about Juan Sebastian Molano had to, you know, do his sprint for the perfect amount of time. I think if you get dropped off with about 175 meters to go, that's the primo distance right there. That's because if it's more than 300 meters, there's a risk that you're going too far. If it's less than that, you know, you could get passed by somebody else, and then what's the point?
I agree in principle, but I think perfect sprint distance varies rider and course and
that's
all
true.
That. But I see what you're saying, that there is a platonic perfect sprint unit.
Right.
That this exists in every stage, and they nailed it.
Okay, maybe if you're Alexander Kristoff, you want to be led out to about 3,000 meters to go, but most people want to be led out to right around there. And it was really just an excellent job from Rui Oliveira, who's not a noted lead out guy. I mean, we have to say, this is not someone who we tend to discuss as being lead out man extraordinaire. He's kind of a domestique extraordinaire. He doesn't win a lot of bike races. And by not a lot of bike races, what I mean is when you go to his pro cycling stats page and you click on the wins section, you'll notice there are none. So this is clearly a rider who races in support of others, but he did it quite perfectly there on on stage 12, and finished fourth himself. That's how far up he was at the end. So Juan Sebastian Milano had to do very little, but he did exactly what he needed to do to pip Caden Groves, who is clearly the best sprinter thus far at this race. So yeah, hats off.
Abby, is that something that comes up a lot? Like, do you find that there are domestiques or like secret leadout people whose primary job in the peloton is different, and then one day they're like, hey, you're leading out, and they just smash it? I mean, is...
Yeah, I think there's riders that have... that are good at something, and they maybe get kind of pigeonholed into something for a while, but that doesn't mean that they don't have other strengths. And like, usually a domestique is going to be good at a lot of things. So slotting into a lead out train is something that they probably should be able to do pretty seamlessly, unless they're like specifically a climbing domestique, which those riders can pivot into like a GC leader pretty easily. Segue. Just kidding. You know, that's, I mean, technically you could use that as a segue.
I'm gonna. I mean, I've been prompted to. And as a fellow podcast host, I think, have a really good insight into what a good segue is, so I'm going to use it. Let's talk GC.
I also want to point out that, like, domestiques in the World Tour Peloton were, like, top of their class everywhere
right.
else. So like a guy who's like a domestique in the World Tour Peloton who can also slot into a lead out, like he was probably winning sprints in like the juniors. So they know how to do that.
Yeah, and kind of to that point of having a lot of skills. I mean, this is, I remember when Marcel Kittel was at, you know, at the height of his powers, you would always hear that he was a hill climb champion too, you know, and he could actually time trial quite well. And it's one of those things where, yeah, they are obviously known for this one thing, and they're all, especially if you're a domestique, you need to be good at everything, as you said. All right, let's talk GC. Sepkus, I think he survived his way through the second week. He didn't have to do too much in terms of facing his rivals, because they kind of exploded on their own. Imploded? Exploded? I don't really know in what way they... You know, imploded. Disintegrated, whether it was outward or inward, but it was not good for Remco.
Slowly decelerated. There weren't any, well, Remco, obviously, but I think a lot of the, like I said, after the TT, I think it was really an unsettled GC, and there were guys who were like, oh, yeah, Mark Soler is doing really well, or Lenny Martinez was up there. And it's just, it's very, like, now we have kind of, we at the beginning of the week, we got our first GC, and now we're kind of seeing people can then, you know, do well or implode or et cetera. I don't know.
I think you make a good point. And actually, Lenny Martinez is a great example of this, where I think the question for Sepkus as a race leader here is he going to collapse at some point? This is his third Grand Tour of the year. Is he going to have a bad day?
And in fifth Grand Tour in a row.
Right.
Yeah. Oof.
And in the end, it's everybody else having the bad day. It's his rivals having the bad day. And so he's been quite... impressive at surviving this race of attrition. All right, Remco completely collapsed going over the Albisque. They hadn't even reached the Tourmalet yet, and it was over for him as a GC contender, at least. And all of a sudden, it's a Jumbo dominated race. We didn't really get much of an explanation for Remco. I mean, he didn't talk to media, which I don't begrudge him of that. I'm sure it was a pretty shitty day, pardon my French, but we didn't really we don't really know anything more about why he had such a bad day. All we know is that he immediately came out swinging the next day, won the stage the next day. So we don't really know why he failed so miserably on the Col d'Albisque and lost all that time. But here we are, and Sepkus, just like I said, he survived. I would also say it's important to note that he survived his own teammate trying to go for the stage win and getting initially quite a big gap. Jonas Vingegaard decided to go win that Tourmalet stage. And as a good teammate, Sepkus did not chase him down until nobody else was around to follow him. And he did keep the gap relatively small. And at this point, it feels like that's kind of where we are. It's Sepkus looks like the heavy favorite unless his own teammates decide to keep doing that sort of thing.
The Vingegaard attack, I thought, was really cool because I really interpreted it as, you know, Vingegaard, he didn't look great in the TT, and I think maybe he's under, you know, his top level, which is still outstanding. And so he was sort of playing the Sepkus role, going for that early attack, trying to make the rest of the group chase, especially because it was a very windy, a tailwind climb for a lot of that stretch, which I think would have made it really hard to get separation. And to sort of go to the way Kuss is riding, he didn't try to make a separation except for when he got around to a section with a good headwind. You could kind of see him wind it up from the back of the field to kind of get that draft and then try to hit the front with a bunch of speed. Had to go around a fan, but it was still like very smart, very cerebral. It's the same way he rides in a support role where he's like, you know, I'm going to ride with this group. Okay, I'm dropping this group. What's the next best thing I can do? How can I get back up to the front? And I think he's doing that on GC too, and I think that's awesome to see.
Yeah, I thought Kuss looked extremely strong when he did finish that stage off, and that really gave me some confidence in his ability to kind of hold on should his teammates want to keep doing this, you know, going for stage wins. I do wonder, I mean, how are they going to play the next week? We'll get to this in a bit, what comes ahead of the next week, but there doesn't really seem to be, I don't see how any other teams are able to actually overhaul Jumbo here. I mean, I can't really see any scenarios where UAE is able to dislodge three Jumbo riders from where they currently are. Is there something I'm not thinking of here? Is there any way that this is going to change?
I don't know how it can. I mean, it's pretty crazy that the three of them are currently the top three in the GC, and also that, you know, everybody, part of the reason that Kuss is leading the race overall is because he's got those two guys that everyone was looking at when he went away in that breakaway to get the time that that secured him kind of the red jersey. But it's just nuts. I feel like it's impossible. Maybe you're looking at the top three and it's like, oh my gosh, like a Jumbo Visma 1-2-3, but it's impossible to be disheartened by it because Kuss is the one leading, I feel like. Perhaps if it was Vinigo leading or Roglic leading, two guys who'd already won the other two Grand Tours of the year, that it would have been a little bit easier to kind of be bummed about it. But I don't know how anyone could see how Sepp's been riding this year, like in all of the Grand Tours, and also how he's riding right now and his smile coming across the line on the Col de Tourmalet, and not just be like, okay, this guy is something really special, which he is. But also, like, I think it would be incredible if he was able to keep the lead over the week. I think it's not so much other teams unseating them as if Sepp can hold on to it for the final week, because he's got so much in the legs at this point. And I think he's riding super well right now, but he's also really young, so you never know like when it's going to become derailed.
So I have two thoughts. First of all, I want to point out that I believe the bookies' favorites at the start of the race were Vingegaard and then Roglic. So even I think it would be kind of boring if that were your 1-2, if Kuss weren't, you know, at the top of the leaderboard. I don't think it would be especially surprising. I think it would be the opposite of surprising. It's exactly what was expected by the people who make their money off of this sort of thing. So it is nice, though, that Kuss is up there, because that's kind of changes everything. Then it takes it from, like, just what we expected but boring to, hey, look at this exciting thing where this guy finally gets his chance. But yeah, in terms of whether he can hold on, to me, the real question, though, is why wouldn't he if Jumbo is the team setting the pace? Because if Jumbo's the team setting the pace and he can't hold on, then it's kind of Jumbo's fault. It kind of, to me, comes down to how much do they really want Sepp Kuss to win. Because if they put riders on the front, if Wilco Kelderman is doing, you know, big pulls at the front to set a pace, and that's what drops Sepp Kuss, then it's kind of the team's own fault. And I would be kind of mad if I were Sepp Kuss and that happened.
The only thing that comes to mind for me is less, you know, is Jumbo going to drop Sepp Kuss, and more how, if he has a not great day, how long are they going to ride for him before they're like, okay, maybe these two guys who are, you know, between a minute and a half and 2 minutes behind you, when do we throw the switch from ride for Kuss to ride for Roglic or ride for Vinigo, depending on race situation? And not that I am hoping that happens, but it could get extremely interesting if, you know, Ayuso or Mas or somebody gets in a bigger breakaway, because they have, you know, obviously they're going to be watched closely, but, you know, they're getting, you know, the top 10 is still 8 minutes from the lead of the race. So the potential for big rider with some time and Sepkus bad day, what does Jumbo do? How do they chase really hard to keep the gap down, even if it's going to drop Kus? Do they let Roglic not gain time when he possibly can? It's just very, I see some potential for this 1-2-3 at the top of the GC thing to create opportunities for enterprising opponents.
While we're still talking about GC, Cosmo, last week we introed a little segment, little smart move versus questionable judgment, an opportunity for us to give out kudos or also give out, I don't know, what's the opposite of kudos?
Like tisks, demerits.
Tisks, yeah. You have some tisks for everybody who's, you know, not Jumbo and not Remco, yep, basically, on stage 14.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, stage 14, the GC group, you know, obviously had let Remco go, and they all kind of just cruised into the finish. On the one hand, I get it. Like, it's tough if you're in a small group, three people from the same team leading the GC, all super strong. But at the same time, like, there's not all that much Vuelta left. And if you were planning to do something, that would have been a good time to try and do it, I think. But it just, you know, everyone really, I want to say soft-pedaled. There were definitely some people fighting at the back, trying to stay in touch. But there, I felt like there were opportunities to at least test. I joked around on Twitter about how there was a cop who was just strutting down the side of the road with zero, like uphill, with zero awareness of the race coming around him. And I thought that could have been a good opportunity to kind of, you know, ride right up behind the cop and then cut across the road and make an attack. Because that cop was not moving and it would have been hard to follow. But I just, you know, you got to take chances, especially when you're this overwhelmed by one team. You know, if you sit on, you're supporting the status quo. And I'm not trying to say no one should fight for seventh or eighth in the overall at the Vuelta, but I don't think if you can take a shot at this point in the game that you shouldn't take it. Like, I would have liked to see a little more action there, so I didn't think that was a great way for the GC contenders to comport themselves.
No, I could agree with that for sure. Abby, I have a question for you. Have you ever been in a race where an attack or any kind of move was discouraged by a director because it was going to jeopardize a top 10 finish?
No.
Well, that's good to hear. I think a lot of people will be happy to hear that because it does seem teams ride that way in Grand Tours.
It does seem like that, but also I've never been in a Grand Tour. So I think that is a completely different.
Yeah.
I think perhaps it's not a fair, I'm not a fair person to answer that question, but I think it is only in a Grand Tour where you would be riding this way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it is frowned upon by us here.
The three of us are frowning.
The viewers, we're
actually kind of smiling,
Grand Tours.
Yeah.
I will say I have known some Category 3 men's racers who are very intent on defending their seventh place at the.
There you go. Okay, so Cat 3 and belows, and Grand Tours.
Same thing.
Same.
Yeah. All right. I want to talk about a stage hunter real quick. I want to give him some kudos. Smart move, and maybe also on the other side of that, call out someone's questionable judgment. And I want to preface this by saying, based on social media, I think I'm one of the few people who kind of rooted for this to happen. I got the sense that people were rooting against this happening today and on Sunday. Stage 15, Rui Costa took the stage win out of the breakaway. First Grand Tour stage win, am I right, at 10 years, I believe? I believe his last Grand Tour stage win came at the Tour de France in 2013. So it had been just a little bit of time since he took a stage win, and he pulled it off today out of a group of, well, it was three, and then it was two, and then it was three again. So Costa, Leonard Kamna, and Santiago Buitrago got off the front of the break in the waning kilometers of stage 15. Leonard Kamna crashed, went down, took a corner too hot. By the way, the broadcast said it was bad luck, and I just want to reiterate something I said on this podcast many times before, that's not bad luck. You know, don't take the turn like that. Anyway, good for Kamna, though. He was able to get back on and rejoin the group. And then, as if he were surprised by this, Rui Costa didn't want to do any work, and he wanted somebody else to lead out the sprint, which, if you've watched bike racing at any point over the last decade and a half, you would know that's how he is. A lot of people don't like that about him. I think it's great. I think it's entertaining. If it didn't work, he wouldn't do it. If it didn't work, bike racing would be boring as well. I mean, like, Rui Costa is the embodiment of what makes bike racing way more entertaining to watch than a marathon. And, you know, sorry, haters, but he's going to do it if it works. And it worked to perfection. Somehow he got Leonard Kamna to lead out the sprint. I don't know how. They're all, you know, going all over the road playing cat and mouse. And Kamna was the one at the end who was leading the race with 300 meters to go. He put in an admirable effort. But Costa took the win in the end. And of course he did. He was in the right position. He let Kamna lead things out. So I had to tip my chapela, because that's what Rui Costa won today for having won the stage, for the smart move of Rui Costa, not doing any work, not doing any more work than was required. I believe he also cajoled Buitrago into doing some work in that group, which Buitrago probably didn't need to do. But yeah, good on Costa for playing everybody. He played them. And, you know, unfortunately, sorry, Leonard Kamna, but you got to know that's going to happen, right? You got to know that's coming. So better luck next time.
Were people frustrated with Rui Costa, his tactics, or that he served time for doping, so they don't want him to?
I think it's the tactics, because
it was. I think it was only 6 months.
Yeah, I think
they
determined it was supplement suspension. When I usually see the criticism of Costa, it is about the fact that he never likes to work. He says mean things to people in breakaways to get them to do work for him, which I'm just thinking, like, good for him. If he can pull that off, I have no problem with this.
Mom, he said something mean to me.
When I see criticism, that's what it usually is about Rui Costa, I think. I mean, I can't read people's minds, but I think that's what it is. So
I don't know. You know, like, cycling fans hold grudges, yep. And so there might be a little bit of the...
Absolutely.
A tiny bit
that's
of
true.
The... Just the headline that he did...
That's
have a doping suspension.
Do we have time for a quick accidental doping anecdote?
Let's hear it.
So this morning, my dog has...
Oh, no.
Yeah, my dog had a weird microbial infection, and so she's been on doxycycline. And this morning, I cut a doxycycline tab in half on a plate, and I put it in her food bowl, and I put the other half back in the pill container. And then later in the day... I put some food on that plate and ate the plate, and it was tasty food, and I licked the plate and the plate was very bitter, and I realized that this could potentially have been a doping positive.
This is
and
how it
all
happens.
This time, I've always thought these stories are ridiculous. And I'm like,
this has literally happened. Yeah.
I just did it. Unfortunately, it's doxycycline, and I don't even think I have a USAC license right now. So I'm not in the testing pool, and it wouldn't be a big deal. But still, I was like, wow, that could actually happen.
Yep. Well, there you go.
And it did.
Well,
it did.
I hope it all gets better, Cosmo.
Yeah, she's doing fine. Yeah. As soon as she got on the meds, she perked right back up. But
well, that's good.
I was worried for a couple of days.
All right. Hope Cosmo's dog gets better. Tip of the cap to Rui Costa. A opposite of the tip of the cap to Leonard Kamna. But hey, he did already win a stage. Good for him. Unheralded riders. Cosmo, who you like so far in this Vuelta that maybe deserves a little more credit?
Chan Otterbrooks, he's like 20, I think. He is ninth on GC currently. I'll have to check. But he has been riding really well, taking chances when it's not going to cost him a lot of time, riding smart when the potential for losing time is huge. I think he's also been fighting through saddle sores or something during the race. So yeah, just a strong performance. I think he's gotten a little camera time, but maybe not as much shout out around behind the Jumbo 1-2-3 as maybe he could have.
Yeah, for those who don't follow every Tour de l'Avenir, he won last year's Tour de l'Avenir, the race of the future, the race that generally kind of highlights the best prospects in the sport. Former winners include Tadej Pogacar, Egan Bernal, and a boatload of others, and he was last year's winner. So he's a rider who has had a lot of pressure on him for some time already. If you're a Belgian 20-year-old winner of the Tour de l'Avenir, you better believe you're getting a lot of pressure back home. So good for Otterbrooks. In his first ever Grand Tour, he's currently holding on to that top 10. All right, let's close out the Vuelta convo with, you know, what's ahead? how are things going to play out in this last week? There is some climbing ahead, unsurprisingly. Possibly the hardest climb in cycling awaits in this final week of the Vuelta. Stage 17. The Alto de l'Angliru awaits on stage 17. It's a 9 and change percent average gradient over 13K. It's absurdly difficult. And they're going over two Cat 1s in the run-up to it, too, so they're not going to be fresh. Yeah, this is a climb where if you are having a off day or even just a mediocre day, you could lose a boatload of time. It's the sort of climb that could really end your GC hopes if you're in your third Grand Tour of the year. So, American fans will probably be hoping that Sepp Kuss is on a good day for Stage 17. Because if he can make it through that, then I think he can make it through anything. There's a climbing stage on Stage 18. There's more climbing on Stage 20. But really, that Stage 17 is the real big challenge for Sepp Kuss's GC aspirations. I think Jumbo-Visma has to be pretty confident, though, that no matter what happens, if Sepp Kuss falls apart on Stage 17, I feel pretty confident personally that either Jonas Vingegaard or Primoz Roglic are going to be fine. The Angliru seems like a place where Vingegaard could put minutes into everybody else, and only out of, you know, respect and mercy for his own teammate would he not do that. So we'll see. Let's close out the Vuelta conversation with the best part of the podcast. Abby, who's going to win the Vuelta?
My heart says Sepp, but my brain says Vingegaard.
Cosmo?
That's kind of where I am. I would almost say my brain is ready to get on the Sepp train, but I already said Vingegaard last week. I have no reason to change that, despite a not amazing time trial. So that's kind of where I'm going to stay, and I'll be pleasantly surprised if I'm wrong.
As far as I know, my heart and my brain are connected. If they weren't, I don't think I'd be having this conversation on this podcast. I'm all in on Sepp Kuss. I actually think it's either Roglic or Kuss, and I really do believe that if Kuss does not win this race, it's Jumbo's fault entirely, and I think it's bad PR. And I think, as we've talked about many times before, this is a team that does a darn good job of keeping its many, many talented riders happy. Just ask Christophe Laporte during the Classics. I think they're going to ride for Sepp Kuss, and they're going to do what they can to put him over the top. But we'll see. We got a week to go. Obviously, if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably going to be watching, but definitely watch the last week of the race and absolutely watch the Angliru stage 17. That's going to be the big one, I think. All right, that's the Vuelta for now. A week from now, we'll be back to talk about how it all played out. Let's talk CMAC Ladies Tour. Abby, just give us, set the scene. What happened at the race? 15, 30 seconds. Can you just tell? Because, again, if you're listening to this podcast, I think you probably roughly know what happened. But set the scene for us.
Yeah, it was a 6-stage race in the Netherlands with 1 stage in Belgium, 7.42 kilometer long time trial, pretty short. SD Works took home 3 stages, with Lotto Kopecky winning the time trial on home soil, which was pretty cool, actually, for her to race the time trial in Leuven, where the Worlds were in 2021, in the national champ jersey, the Belgian national champ jersey, as the world champion, was pretty amazing. And then she also won the Queen stage in Valkenburg, which finished atop the Kauberg, where the AMSO gold race finishes. So it was a pretty good stage. Lorena Wiebes won the final stage. So that's SC Works with the 1-2-3. And then Charlotte Kuhl won 2 stages, the opening prologue, 2.4 kilometer long prologue, and a sprint stage on stage 3. Elisa Bosmo is back in style and won the other sprint stage, stage 1, ahead of Wiebes and Kuhl, which was cool. And that was that. So yeah, Kopecky took the overall. Wiebes was second by just 5 seconds, I believe, in the end. And Anna Henderson, the Brit on Jumbo-Visma, took 3rd after her teammate crashed on stage 4. And Rihanna Marcus had an incredible time trial. Per usual, the Dutch national time trial champion, but crashed on the Valkenburg stage and fell out of the general classification. So Anna Henderson made it up by third overall.
All right, so lots of things to talk about here, but first of all, I want to point out, I like time trials, but even I have limits. And if you start a race with a prologue, I don't think you should have a time trial on stage two. Just hold off until like stage four, at least.
It was a little bit, and also like a 2.4 kilometer long prologue and then a 7 kilometer long time trial was a bit of like they could have done a double day.
Yeah, if you could mix it up a little bit more than that, come on, organizers. But when all was said and done, it was a pretty cool showcase of, you know, people's ability to go really, really hard for a shorter period of time over every day. That was kind of the way that this race was won. If you were good at that, you're going to win the race. I think we all know that Lotta Kopecky's pretty good at that, so maybe not that big of a surprise that she took the overall victory. But one thing that stood out to me, I mean, they took both Wiebes and Kopecky to this race. That's their, you know, their fast finishing duo, and they managed to kind of boss the whole race with both of them getting in their, you know, getting in their results.
Yeah,
which is not easy to do.
I might push back on that a little bit because Wiebes did not. I mean, she lost to Cole and she lost to Balsamo. And what I thought was like the whole first week, I thought there were some spicy sprints in this. We didn't quite have a good overhead shot of a lot of them, so maybe the views we had were a little misleading. But it definitely seemed like there was one moment on the stage that Balsamo won where Kopecky was leading out, looked over her shoulder, saw Cole coming up, and immediately turned in front of her right as the sprint was about to launch. And then there was another moment where I think it was Jayco was leading out. It might have been Liv. I think it was Jayco because they had the white kits, not the purple ones.
Yeah, it was
Jayco. Yeah, and like one of the leadouts kind of did the same move back to Wiebes, like sort of just cutting over right as she was about to launch, and that was the sprint that Cole won. And you know, maybe it's just a stay work season that they've been having so far, but you kind of think every time a sprint stage isn't won by Lorena Wiebes, like Estee Works must have screwed up. I think she rode great. I think she looked amazing up the Cowberg, but at the same time, maybe they wanted more out of this race, which is wild to say. But.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's interesting watching, especially the first stage that Balsamo won. It was Estee Works was super critical of themselves actually after the race and how they messed up that lead out. But it was also a combination of that and that Ilaria Sanguinetti, the lead out rider for Balsamo, just crushed it. Like she did such an amazing job, and it was like they were one person, the two of them, the way that they rode into that sprint together.
Did they hit the platonic awesome sprint unit?
Oh yeah. Is this wow. Yeah.
Also awesome to see Balsamo winning after her like horrendous crash in Ride London. But yeah, the cool stage was a lot of other teams getting in Wiebes's way, which could have been her positioning going into it for sure. I don't think it was Jayco's fault that Wiebes was there. But it was definitely, there was an interesting moment with Georgia Baker leading out Letizia Paternoster and kind of getting in the way of Wiebes there. And she really had to stop pedaling for a second, which would impede your sprint. But also worth noting that they also brought Demi Vollering to this race, but she left early due to illness. So they had all three of their just completely insanely strong riders on the start line.
I wonder, is it, this is sort of a broader question for you, Abby, that maybe is more of a placeholders or wheel talk style question, but I do wonder, is it the location being in the Low Countries? Is it just that this is a World Tour race? I mean, what is it that drew all those stars to this specific race in September? Why here at the CMAC Ladies Tour? I mean, you can understand why they would go to the Tour de France Femme, but why would there be so many heavy hitters at this race?
This is a really iconic race on the calendar, the Holland Ladies Tour. It's been around for a while, and a lot of prestigious riders have won it in the past. Part of it is that it's a world tour race. So, you know, there are opportunities for people to win. Like Kasia Niwodoma was probably there mostly because of the Valkenburg stage, where she's won the AMSO gold race, you know, in the past. But like, for example, Annemiek van Vleuten was there because it was her first ever pro race that she raced back in 2007. So for her retiring at this race, yeah, it may not sound as beautiful as retiring at the World Championships, but for her retiring here was like a full circle moment, where the first pro race she did, she crashed out of the first stage and DNF'd. So to come back, even though she didn't win it this year, she's won it twice in the past, but even though she didn't win it this year, it's still like there's something about this race. And I think it is, a lot of it is that it's the Dutch. Like obviously three stage wins by the Dutch, and they love this race. It's also like usually it's a really, really exciting race. Like we had some pretty insane finishes in the race last year. It was, yeah, really, really exciting, with the final stage being taken by Misha Bredewolde on, like, with a late race move that was pretty cool, and Rihanna Marcus won one stage solo. So I think, like, you would say, okay, a 5/6 stage race in the Netherlands in the flat, okay, that doesn't sound super exciting, but usually it is quite exciting, and there's usually like crosswind stages and stuff, but this year we had a heat wave, so there wasn't any winds to make things a little bit more interesting, but that does happen sometimes. Also, usually this race is right before the Worlds, so like in a normal year it's a prep race for the Worlds, but like this year it's obviously like racing should be done, we should have ended in Glasgow, but that is not the case.
But here we are.
Here we are.
Talking about Van Vleuten's wrapping up her career, it like reminded me a lot of Johan Museeuw, who, rather than finish his career at Roubaix like Andrea Toffi did finished at Childeprist, because I think like that was his first race, or it was like the last classic in Belgium or something. He wanted to retire in Belgium.
Yeah. It certainly seemed like an emotional farewell for Annemiek van Vleuten, and also a final farewell, like not so much of a, hey, just kidding, I'm going to come back next year. Like, it really does seem like she's done. And yeah, just hats off for what a career, and what a last 5, 6, 7 years of her career in particular, where she's just been, you know, year after year, it was her versus Anna van der Breggen, her versus SD Works, or whatever the team was called at the time. I mean, that's what has been the dominant story for so many of the last years of racing in the women's peloton. So it'll be pretty interesting, kind of wild, just different to see the women's peloton, to see racing without her. She's just been such a dominant force, and hopefully somebody will arrive to challenge the SD Works dominance that like she was able to do for so many of those years. We'll
see. Attack their P breaks.
Yes, that as well.
Yeah, I think like I definitely shed a tear today watching her cross the line. It's going to be weird with her not in the peloton, heck, in like 5 days at the Tour de Romandy. But she's really changed the sport. Like, she has definitely raised the bar in women's cycling. She forced a lot of riders to rethink how they were doing things. She forced altitude training onto the peloton. She's completely changed the game, and I think like her retiring is such a massive end of an era, start of something new. Like, obviously she's had Demi Vollering the last 2 years as kind of her rival, but she really embodies this this age of cyclists that is kind of on the way out, and we're bringing in this new era of young women who, from the beginning, from when they're starting, they already know what it means to be a professional. There are already women being paid livable wages instead of having to kind of ride for free and stuff. That still exists. And there's still riders riding for free in the World Tour. But like, things are changing rapidly, and she's part of this old generation that had to do things a lot differently than the riders coming up now. So yeah, it was cool to see her leave this way. She didn't win a stage. She said before the race that she wasn't planning to go for the GC. And I think in the end, she just didn't have the legs. But seeing her roll across the line today to her mom and a massive crowd of supporters, and then they made a huge to-do about her on the podium, and there were kids that got up and said that she was their inspiration and stuff. And I mean, she really is for so many people. So it's, I don't know, it feels just like, I feel like a bit almost in denial that she's not going to be in the peloton anymore, because she's just been such a fixture for so long at this point that it's like, I don't know, Tom Brady leaving the one sport that he does. Who would believe it?
That's American football, by the way, for those who don't know who Tom Brady is. But yeah,
I don't know who Tom Brady is. I just have heard his name a lot. Felt like it was a good comparison.
I'm really struck by that kind of, you know, the how different things were when she started versus now. And it's, I mean, you think about even seeing a woman's race at all, like a recap of a woman's race before a men's race would usually be all you get, or somewhere, you know, after the race is done, they're like, here you go. You know, here's a couple seconds of footage. I remember particularly the Mer de Huy. They had the cameras set up for the men's race and just like didn't have them on for the women's race. And now you get pretty solid coverage, at least watchable like bike race coverage, not a recap. And it's kind of cool to see that. I think a lot of the riders, and Abby, you can correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of the riders racing now, like coming into their primes, had kind of developed with the ability to watch races. That you know, this tier of riders who are now leaving were in, and it's just cool.
Yeah, especially the live coverage has been just insane in the last like 3 years, really. Being able to watch that, and like I was chatting with Anna Henderson, who got third of the CMAC Ladies Tour, about does she watch the races, and she said she watches every race. She watches every women's race. She watches every men's race because she needs to learn, because she's new to the sport. She doesn't know how it works. She came from ski racing, not ski jumping, like not like Roglic, like downhill skiing, but so she's new to the sport. So she watches everything, but that used to not be how it was. Like, it used to just be the Olympics, and like Anna Meek really rose to prominence in after her crash at the Rio Olympics, where she hung on to Mara Abbott, the best climber in the world at the time. She hung on to her wheel over the climb and then crashed really hard on the descent. But that was one of the only races that we used to get to see, that we know we get to see from start to finish. And now we get most races at least 2 hours, 3 hours. So it's pretty amazing how much has changed in her career.
Cosmo, before we move on from the CIMAC Ladies Tour, I wanted to give you a chance to herald someone. We'll keep it on the Dutch, though.
Yeah, we didn't see Van Vleuten do a lot of racing, but we saw Floortje Mackay do a lot of really, really powerful, like not just for the sake of attacking, but like legit threatening late attacks. None of them worked out, but there was one particular finish where it was unclear whether or not she had been caught, because she got caught so close to the line. It's kind of twisting, sinuous finish. And it's, yeah, I like that type of racing. And I want to see more of it.
Yeah, that was the final stage. That was weird to watch. I was like, it was really unclear if she got caught or not. And poor Jose was trying to call it. And she also didn't know if she'd been caught or not. And I was just like, this is chaos. Because they had like a finish line, like camera still photo. And it was like, okay, wait, but there's no one in it. And then it was all just very confusing.
All right, so that's the Vuelta, that's the CMAC Ladies Tour. We're not going to do too much of a breakdown of the Tour of Britain on this show because, to be perfectly honest, there's a lot of World Tour racing going on both the men's and the women's side, and I don't know how much we would have to say about the Tour of Britain, where Jumbo-Visma was the dominant team, with Olaf Kooi winning stage after stage, and then Olaf Kooi helping propel Wout van Aert to victory in the overall, courtesy of his win on stage 5. So that's kind of what we would say, I think. If we had a longer conversation, it would generally boil down to that. But yeah, congrats to the Jumbo team. Congrats to Kooi for being a heck of a good sprinter, and Wout van Aert for taking advantage of an opportunity to grab just a few seconds, which proved enough to win the race. Carlos Rodriguez won the final stage. yeah, there's your Tour of Britain. That's kind of our overview, and there you go. All right, let's talk about the GPs, Quebec and Montreal. Let's talk racing in North America, which is 2 days. There's 2 days of World Tour racing in North America right now. It's not much, but hey, it's something.
Woo!
Once a year, for 2 days, we get World Tour racing here in North America. Not in the United States of America, but our dear friends just across the border to the north in Canada. And we had both the GP Quebec and then the GP Montreal this weekend. Friday was the GP Quebec, and we just finished the GP Montreal about an hour ago before we started recording. The Quebec race was the World Tour coming out party for Arnaud Delis, who we've talked about a fair bit on this podcast. I know we've talked about a fair bit on the placeholders as well. He's one of the really up-and-coming talents, the young lights of the men's peloton, 21 years old, and a rare star young talent from the French-speaking part of Belgium. The vast majority of the big-name Belgians that you can probably name come from the Dutch-speaking part, Flanders, but Arnaud Delis is a Walloon, which is reflected in his nickname, Le Taureau Wallon, which he's a bull from Wallonia. And I was struck. I was stricken? I'm not sure. When watching the sprint in Quebec, it was very bull-like because he just kind of kept charging up that hill with like 300 meters to go. He was not quite, it didn't seem like he was going to be the one winning that race. And he just kept going and kept going. And by the end, yeah, had a pretty convincing win. And I think he's a rider who has a very good turn of speed and obviously can hold on for a little while and he can handle the climbs. Just was very promising to me. And yes, I know this is not the Vuelta. I know we're all watching the Vuelta and we may not have the energy to watch another World Tour race at the same time, Kaeli Fretz. But the field here was darn good. I mean, he beat big names. Michael Matthews has won this race before. Michael Matthews was up there in Quebec this time, and Arnaud Delis was able to, yeah, just kind of cruise. He put the power down and just kept going and bested, and also impressive, Corbin Strong, the young New Zealander. So hats off to Corbin Strong of Israel Premier Tech, and Michael Matthews up that final sprint in Quebec. I was really impressed with everything Delis did, and I think it bodes well for a race like Amstel, or maybe even Liège. That's the sort of thing where if you can hold that effort really for that long up a medium gradient, it's a good sign.
You might almost be underselling it. Like, he wasn't in the camera shot for the overhead chopper shot until he was going from third into second at 150 meters to go. Like, he started the sprint like 500 meters from the line in 30th place or something. And I don't know how he ended up back there to start it, but he got some teammates. They wound it up and he just kept going. And it's just, you see the overhead and you're kind of like, what's the matter with these other two riders that he is going past like their children? And it's, yeah, it, like you said, it really bodes. I don't know a ton of other riders that could do that like that up that hill. You know, maybe Vanderpool, but yeah, strong.
Yeah, it was a heck of an effort. All right, then over to Montreal Sunday, the race we just finished watching. I think the big storyline for me was the just perfect execution. Everything worked to plan for the team that won this race. They were on the front. They were the team putting everybody under pressure, dropping everybody, going up and over the Mount Royal, the climb for which the city is named. And UAE eventually propelled Adam Yates to his attack, which Pavel Sivakov joined. First of all, perfect timing. Nobody really had enough team support in the chasing group where there was going to be any cohesion. So as soon as they were gone, I mean, it was pretty clear pretty quickly that they just weren't going to get caught because who was going to chase them down? And then really nice job by Adam Yates to take a very clear and convincing win in the sprint. It was like Sivakov was there, but he barely. Like, he was there, but as soon as Adam Yates got out of the saddle, Sivakov, basically, you could see he just said, all right, yeah, I'll just take second today. That's fine.
When he time trialed across the gap to Yates, which took him a bit, I think it was very much he got that wheel. It was like, cool, second place. Nice.
Yeah, I'll take second.
Like, it was, yeah. I actually thought UAE was riding for Hershey the entire time. I thought that would, I mean, maybe they were, but he didn't. Hershey was a presence in the chase after Yates got away, but he didn't look super strong. So yeah, like hats off to UAE for nailing this one to the mast.
Yeah, it was unclear to me.
It makes sense
too. I also wasn't sure. I just knew that Rafał Majka and Brandon McNulty were working really hard for somebody on that team, and it turned out
that's the thing. Does it really matter until
it could have, maybe,
until that,
you know,
final
maybe
attack?
Hershey is the option if the Adam Yates attack doesn't work. Who knows? But it worked out perfectly for Yates, who got his first one-day win in quite a long time. First World Tour one-day win in quite a long time. Good for Adam Yates. He's had obviously a very good year after his impressive Tour de France. And that's it. That's it. That's your World Tour racing schedule in North America. 2 days. That's where we are, unfortunately, but at least they were entertaining
finales. Mountain bike and cyclocross World Cups coming up. The cycling world headquarters of West Virginia hosts the next Mountain Bike World Cup. And then we go to Mont Saint Anne, which is, it's not far from Quebec. It's also in Quebec. I got internet corrected about this as well, justifiably. But yeah, there's bike racing in North America around this time of year. It's just, there isn't much of it. You're right.
I like the image that popped into my head when you kind of, I think you were jokingly calling West Virginia sort of the world center.
Yes.
And the first thing that popped in my head was like the UCI headquarters in Igel in Switzerland, just being like dropped into the middle of West Virginia. What would that be like? And like, what if David Lapartien had to live in West Virginia?
That would be amazing.
Be pretty cool. Yeah. What if we had that? I don't know.
Get a UCI holler up there.
Yeah. Heck yeah. All right. That's it for us today. We've been serious, pretty serious at least. And hope you've enjoyed the show. Hope you have a chance to watch all the racing this week at the Vuelta, where Sepp Kuss will be doing his darndest to hold on to that red jersey. Abby, Cosmo, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here, Dan. Yeah.
And we'll be seeing you. See you next time.